Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com.
Verdant Earth Educators provides dynamic in-person training and online learning opportunities for environmental and horticultural businesses. Owned by ISA-certified arborists and former university faculty, the Verdant Earth Educator team provides consultations on tree care and recommends climate-resilient opportunities for your valued green spaces. Verdant Earth Educators is all about seeding knowledge for success. Find Verdant Earth Educators at verdanteartheducators.com.
This podcast is being recorded on October 13th, 2023. Ashley Davis joined the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society in 2021 as a tree specialist for the organization to pursue her passion for empowering people to grow tree canopy in their communities. Since joining, she has helped grow the PHS Tree Tenders Program in Bucks, Chester, Delaware, and Montgomery counties to over 60 active groups who have planted 3,000 plus trees. She recently took on the role of facilitating the educational workshops within the program. Prior to her work at PHS, Ashley was introduced to the necessity of healthy urban tree canopy through her work with Tree Philly. Ashley is a PHS tree tender leader in her own community, East Parkside, using her knowledge to educate her neighbors about the benefits of tree planting and care. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Ashley. We're delighted that you could be with us today.
Thanks so much for having me here today, Eva and Hal. I'm very grateful to be one of your guests on this podcast.
Absolutely. Tell us about yourself, Ashley. Tell our listeners how you found your way to urban forestry and to Philadelphia and to tree planting in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, I would love to. So currently, I am a tree specialist with Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. And we believe that horticulture belongs to everyone. And we do that by connecting with communities and meeting them where they are to work together to find greening solutions. And it's pretty funny how I found my way into urban forestry. That was not my study or my discipline. I actually studied culinary arts in college. And I've been in Philadelphia since I was a teenager. And I went to college at Drexel University. And spent some time in the culinary industry, but always found myself walking on trails to decompress and connecting with nature and really using it as, or using the healing properties that are found in trees to kind of center myself and when I needed to get away from the hustle and bustle of the kitchen. And when I decided to make a career change, all I knew was parks and recreation. I didn't know what the career options were in urban forestry. And so my first job was with Tree Philly, which is a organization with Parks and Recreation that's still active to this day. They give away free yard trees through community organizations all throughout Philadelphia. And at Tree Philly, they sent me to a tree tenders class. And that's how I first found out about Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. I became a tree tender and immediately fell in love with the program. I linked up with my community's tree tender group, Centennial Parkside Tree Tenders, and when I wasn't working with Tree Philly, I was organizing with the Centennial Parkside Tree Tenders. And yeah, it grew from there. And now I'm really lucky to be a part of the Trees team and work with all these different communities throughout the
region.
That's
a really great story. I wonder if you were taking in the food of the forest when you were walking.
I was not. that is still a goal of mine to do some foraging. I feel like you have to be really knowledgeable because there are some really great, delicious things and there are some things that can be really harmful and you got to be careful. So now that I'm a little bit more knowledgeable, I am able to take that in. Where that's a great question.
Yeah, it is a fun thing to explore. You know, we're recording this as we go deeper into the fall, and I've got my eye on a group of ginkgo trees. Every year I say, this is the year I'm going to make ginkgo tincture. And evidently you're supposed to use the yellow ginkgo leaves when they fall to the ground. And then, of course, the nutlet, which I have harvested and prepared and, you know, enjoyed it. And there are those options. Maybe we can share a few recipes, but at the end of the hour.
Yes, please. It sounds delicious.
So what is Tree Tenders all about? It's a program of the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society, and it's been doing great work. How would you characterize its role in the urban forest?
Yeah, Tree Tenders is all about educating folks about the importance of urban forestry, but also empowering them through that education. And so giving people the tools that they need so that they feel comfortable going back to their community and growing the canopy there. And so teaching people about tree biology, about how to organize a community planting, about disease and pests to look out for, and then even doing continuing education. So doing pruning courses, doing a community science program where we teach people how to use geographical information systems to track how the trees are doing health-wise. And what I love about Tree Tenders is it's not about going into these spaces and saying, a tree needs to go here. It's really about empowering the folks who live in the community and know and understand their community to be able to say, this is where a tree should go and this is how I envision or how we envision our community being greener and getting all those benefits from trees.
I think that's really a great overview of Tree Tenders, because Tree Tenders is like a general picture of what you do within this context of the city. And it really focuses on people, and the trees are secondary. And I don't like to say they're secondary, but they are. And one of the things I have to ask you is, do you see when people are empowered, do you see them digging deeper into like a specific topic when they kind of jump into the meat of the matter? Do they expand like a little area within the context of all of those topics? What have you noticed since you've been there at PHS?
Yeah, I would say it definitely varies based on the community's needs, right? Like every community has their own priorities and their own focuses. And so some communities may have mature trees that have not had great maintenance, and that's a focus of theirs. Some communities may have little to no canopy at all, and their main focus is getting as many trees as possible into the ground. Some communities are trying to build capacity and like build this safe community of like-minded people. And so for them, the focus is organizing. And something we like to say in the class is think about this program as lichen. So like it's a mutual benefit, whatever you're trying to accomplish. It's benefiting both you and the community, and everybody's working together so that the overall benefit is great.
Yeah, and it's benefiting the trees too, because they get to come in and, yes, and meet the people that they're over like shadowing or shading.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And then there's a better chance for maintenance and stewardship when people are committed to seeing the trees grow in maturity and wanting to benefit from them long term.
So have you seen that people are more community minded once they become a tree tender? Do you think they start to notice other things within their community once they become a tree tender?
I think people come to Tree Tenders because they are community minded.
Okay, that's a good observation.
Yeah, and I think they already have that mindset, but they're now looking for the tools and resources to be able to carry out what they know their community needs.
So much of what Tree Tenders has sought to do, and you mentioned GIS a minute or two ago, Ashale, is, you know, gathering the data, and the maps have been so dramatic. You know, we've talked about Hunting Park as a targeted neighborhood. Can you give us an overview, help our listeners understand this concept of tree equity and why historically some neighborhoods in Philly have gone over 100 years, the history of the city, the length that the city has existed without canopy, versus other neighborhoods that have benefited and enjoyed, you know, an intensive, not only street tree planting, but follow-up maintenance for years and years. And then again, like I said, those maps are so dramatic as far as the green versus the brown versus the yellow. For me, it's always like when it's July, August in Philly, and I'm looking out the window and, you know, appreciating what I have in terms of green and canopy and leafy foliage versus, you know, the poor neighborhoods that just are baking in the sun.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point, how there's a 22 degree difference in areas that have the canopy, which is the recommended canopy is 30%, versus areas that have as little as less than 1% canopy.
Yeah.
And I honestly would say to really understand land stewardship in this area, we really have to go all the way back to how it was originally stewarded by indigenous communities, and that this was like a flush forest at one point that was naturally stewarded with best practices that we have really gotten away from. And a lot of that really declined in the industrial era when it was a big boom of a lot of factories. And then that led to a lot of building of densely compacted housing to try to fit a lot of people who were working into one area. And that got rid of a lot of our green spaces. And then when the Great Depression happened and those factories closed, those who could afford to move to areas that are considered suburbs now, so greener spaces that are close to the city, or but not necessarily within the heart of the city. So we have spaces like Northwest Philly, which is really great and beautiful and lush and green, but that was where a lot of people went to establish themselves, where they wanted to still have access to green spaces. And so those who couldn't afford to move stayed in these areas. And there was something called, I'm a little bit of a history buff when it comes to
That's
this.
Great.
So, yeah, let's do it.
For some people, it may not seem related, but it does affect it. So there was, at this time in the Great Depression, the president at the time, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, put out the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And the idea of this was that it would provide relief to people who lost their jobs en masse so that they could retain their homes, could pay for anything that they needed to do to be able to stay in their spaces and fix up any declining infrastructure. But the officers that went out to give out these loans had very racist intentions and practices, and they drew literal red lines. So some people may have heard the idea behind redlining or heard the phrase redlining. And they drew literal red lines around Black and Brown communities and immigrant communities and decided that they would receive either subprime loans, meaning really high interest rates, or no loans at all. And there was a ranking system, red being the worst or D, and it went from A to D. So those folks were left without any funds to be able to maintain the infrastructure. Then you have these abandoned buildings that some are still prevalent around the city, these abandoned factories that contribute to the declining climate. And you can't build on them. You can't add any green infrastructure because there's not funds to remove those buildings and replace them with something beneficial. But even through all of that, with vacant lots being in place people still found ways and were still passionate about greening their spaces, and they saw the need and they were like, I'm going to plant a community garden here. I'm going to plant a tree here. It was like a lot of guerrilla planting, which is really incredible. It didn't stop with redlining. It continued on this continued disinvestment in these communities that just were not seen as valuable, were not seen as worthy. There's also the issue of what's called white flight, which is really like economic flight that's not necessarily just white people, but people who have higher income. And so when you don't have the money and you don't have the resources, and then you're not getting that source from other entities, then you aren't able to carry out what you would like to see in your community. And all that being said too, I mean, at the time, there wasn't a lot of government investment in parks either. And so, that's something I really admire about this program too. Mindy Maslin founded this program 30 years ago when it was not popular to plant trees. Trees were not a political issue. I mean, we're really lucky to be here at a time right now where there's this IRA funding and there's this, the Philly Tree Plan just got released. And so there's a lot of great energy behind trees, but that was not always the case. All that to say, like, here we are at this current map and landscape of Philadelphia and surrounding counties. And this is replicated in other cities too. It's not unique just to Philadelphia, where there are areas that have high canopy, have great air quality, have less impervious surfaces. And then there are areas that have really low canopy and the socioeconomic status is lower. And we see the correlation of low canopy to those same Black and Brown communities, to those same areas that were disinvested in the past, because the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago and the second best time is now. And so we see that those effects in those maps now. And so when we call an area high priority and there's maps available that show this, it's because it's a need for tree canopy that also affects air quality, that also affects stormwater management, that also affects wildlife, that also affects cooling and shading and
mental health.
Summers, mental health.
Right.
Yeah. By gun violence, so many things.
Well,
yeah.
One of the things that, you know, wasn't until the 1980s when Ehrlich did his studies about having a tree outside of a hospital window. I mean, he was one of the very early ones, and then Kaplan came along and did all their studies. But one of the things that happened here in Philadelphia, and I remember it distinctly because we always traveled back and forth down in town every weekend to visit my grandmother down in Northern Liberties, but also to go to church down there. And the trees that were in the city, in the areas that are now classified as no canopy, had trees, but they never replanted them. When they came down, they never replanted them because they said, why should we bother? And that was like in the 1970s when everybody had a hands-off with parks. We're not doing anything with parks. We're just going to let them go. We don't have the money. That's how invasives took off, because there was this hands-off of our park systems. And you've hit a lot of really good points when you were saying, this is happening and this is happening. White flight, the redlining, all of that is something that we really should be ashamed of and change it, fix it. Go back and look at it and say, okay, we made huge mistakes. Let's see how we can change those mistakes. And I think that someone like Mindy, who started the Tree Tenders organization, because she was a social worker, she was ahead of her time because she was already seeing all this and recognizing the disparity within the communities of Philadelphia because she was working in the city of Philadelphia. And that's where I think Tree Tenders is really pulling the city up by its bootstraps. That's what it's doing. That's how I feel.
Well, it's definitely a prime catalyst. And in 2022, the city of Philadelphia released its Philly Tree Plan.
Yes.
And did a great job with it. And we have reviewed it. We've talked to Ari and Alexa about it. And the thing that has impressed us, and I hope other cities take note, is the effort and energy that went into getting community input. So it wasn't just a handful of urban forestry experts and landscape architects. It was talking through a intensive series of community outreach meetings where input was given. So I wonder how tree tenders will be a part of supporting the city's mission to restore and maintain canopy. With the Philly Tree Plan out, and also the recent development of the money that is coming from Washington, D.C., I believe it's about $12 million. And so in some ways, the gears have been shifted. We're going to the next level, whereas it used to be, you know, city council allotting some money and flower show revenue funding tree tenders. All of a sudden, there's $12 million. How do you see us moving forward with that? It's a little bit daunting, isn't it?
It's daunting and exciting. Yeah. And I'll say personally, I hope that it leads to even more funding. I hope that, I mean, because to be completely honest, the $12 million doesn't cover what the actual cost and recommendation of the plan recommended, the cost to actually restore the canopy.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, that's a great question. How, I mean, we've had a lot of great ideas about how we could engage tree tenders. And I do want to give credit to those tree tenders who were part of the community steering committee for the Philly Tree Plan as part of those voices, and who have been volunteering their time to grow our tree canopy up to this point. I can't say officially how PHS is going to engage. Something I would love to see, saying as Oshelay, I would love to see that funding going towards, and what's great about the IRA funding too is that it has to go towards high need communities. And I would love to see that going towards compensation for our tree tenders who have been doing this work, whether that's through grant funding or them getting some sort of hourly wage for their work, or maybe they purchase some tools or things that they need to continue to care for the trees that they have in their community. Because I think that's the next step of making this work sustainable for those communities that are high priority for us.
So in a sense, job creation.
Exactly. Yeah, workforce development. Yeah.
Fabulous idea. And that once you empower people, you can't stop them, right? Once somebody feels that what they're doing is needed and they get their paycheck and they feel like something's happening, that's very important for self-esteem, mental health, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I just want to note, like, folks are doing this while also holding a full-time job. There was a study recently done that most of our volunteers are retirees, but we do have a number of people that outside of their full-time job, they're volunteering and doing this and putting in work as well because they believe in it so much. So how, just like you said, how empowering would it be for them to do what they're passionate about and get compensation for it?
Sure. You know, as we talk about canopy, it'll be interesting to see how, you know, if sidewalk cutting, tree pit prep, and ultimate planting, if it's as it accelerates, if it'll also allow for, you know, maybe targeting the individual blocks. So rather than, you know, two red buds going in, maybe it's a dozen trees going in so that you're getting, grabbing an accelerated rate of canopy capture, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's just me thinking of, you know, a perspective of, wow, you know, if you can green it up a little faster, it would be even better.
Yeah, we agree. I agree. It's something that is really cool about the planting priority map in Philadelphia.
Right.
And in the counties, we work with Delaware Valley Regional Planning Commission and use their sidewalk prioritization map. You can see block by block where the highest priority or the highest need is based on these equity scores. And so that's the really nice thing. We do encourage our tree tender groups, like, zoom in and maybe go canvas on this block so that so that they can have just a great transformation and always an opportunity for a block party.
We're so fortunate that this GIS all came at the same time because we're seeing a perspective that we really haven't seen before. And we can really call it. We could say that look what redlining did. Look what happened to these communities where there was heavy industry and now there's nothing. And how we can transform it I don't think there's anything more powerful than the tool that was given to PHS has been using it for a while, the idea of looking at GIS and saying, okay, this is, something's not right here. We've got a lot of trees here and across the street, there's nothing, you know? It's a very powerful tool.
Absolutely.
Well, and the hope is that it influences decision makers. You know, we're heading towards a mayoral election. We're going to have a new administration. I'm sure that at some level that's going to impact Parks and Rec and other agencies, you know, that also feed into the tree planting scenario. So we're about 5 weeks away from the big planting weekend. And it's a bustling time when the trees come in from Schichtel's Nursery in Springfield, New York. And I guess maybe you have a couple other sources these days. What's it like leading up to planting day? It seems like there's a lot of moving parts.
There are a lot of moving parts. How I like to describe it is there are hundreds of events happening over the same weekend led by hundreds of people. So if you think about planning one event multiple times over, this season, we're proud to say it's our second largest planting in a season.
Wow.
Bravo.
Kudos.
Planting over 1,700 trees. Thank you. And yeah, so leading up to planting day, we do host a number of trainings. Again, we're all about support and education. So we host a number of trainings for our leaders to help them feel prepared. Definitely some Q&A sessions. And on their side, if they're in Philadelphia, we're currently going through each individual site and marking the sidewalks for where the trees are going to go, called pit surveys. And then our contractors will go out, cut that concrete, and then fill the soil back up to grade with the soil mixture that we approve. And likewise, our tree tender leaders are notifying the tree recipients, are putting in the information with us about when they'll come pick up their trees and getting their information together about the amount of volunteers they'll need on the day, where all the trees are going to be planted, what the meeting place is going to be. And we always are big on provide refreshments. So thinking through all those details. In the counties, we don't provide cut and sidewalks. A lot of the trees are often planted in yard spaces or park spaces. So they're doing similar organizing in terms of figuring out meeting spaces, figuring out how many volunteers they need. They are responsible for doing what's called a PA1 call. So they'll call to get, it's a state-provided service where they'll come out and survey the site to make sure there's no gas lines or electric lines and it's okay to dig at that site and plant a tree. And then for us on the PHS side, we are finalizing those trees in Philadelphia. I would say my colleague Jahan is literally an Excel whiz, is matching literally every individual tree to a site, making sure that the right tree goes in the right place. That's a mantra we like to say. So for example, if a tree is going under some wires, it will be a small species. If it's close to a building, it'll be something narrow form, et cetera. On the county side, we are sending out invoices because people pay a subsidized amount. We are finalizing those order confirmations. And then we get to, it's literally like for us event planning as well. So before we go to our distribution site or our warehouse, we're making labels for every individual tree to make sure that they're going to the proper group. We're making order sheets for every group to make sure that they get all the trees that they're supposed to get. Tree, if you think about it, these trees are going to their forever home. And so if a tree gets planted somewhere that it's not supposed to be planted, it can only really be planted once without going through too much stress. And so we want to make sure that everything ends up in the right place. And then we're also thinking about our own volunteers. How many people do we need when we get to unloading day? How many people do we need to help unload these 1,700 trees and sort them into the 90 plus groups that are helping bringing these trees back to their community? How many people do we need help with when we have pickup slots for these groups to come pick up their trees? Then we need to load the trees up into their trucks so that they can take them back to their communities. And then on planting day, on the planting weekend, We are really lucky that we get to go out and plant with our communities and our leaders. And so we'll typically go either in a high priority community and communities that are planting for the first time so that we can be there and support them through the plantings and offer whatever need and expertise that they need. We also organize other experts in the area. So great arborists like the two of you that are always supportive and going out and helping with planting as well.
You know, what I think is really fabulous is that you have come up with so many copyable protocols so that other communities can use those protocols as well. I know Hal and I talk about that all the time. You know, you have, this is how they do the trees. And when they come off the truck, this is what happens. This is how they're done. And, you know, when you just went through all those protocols, and there's a lot of them, are they written down somewhere in a book?
Not in a book, but we do have a big OneDrive file. A big electronic folder that we all share.
It's a lot.
I'm glad to work with very organized people who have done this many times. And so they've passed on the knowledge.
It is worth giving a shout out. What do you call it? Your hub? It handles so much
absolutely.
Traffic as far as announcing dates and announcing the need for volunteers and technical information and things like that. So shout out to the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's tech people as well, right?
Yeah, their marketing team. Yeah, they're incredible.
They may not be planting trees, but they're certainly doing the behind the scenes important stuff too. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And some of them come out and plant trees too,
yeah,
which is incredible. Yeah, they're a great team. Absolutely. Thank you for that, Hal.
So how much are you able to accommodate? I know there's eager listeners out here wondering, you know, what is Tree Tender's commitment to native trees versus the tough, versatile imported trees from Asia and Europe? And
yeah.
I should say that, you know, I do get the sense that the Delaware Valley has a certain impassioned followers of a certain writer from Delaware whose name comes up just about every planting day.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say we do reference that when we were choosing species. We'll reference that, those books.
Yeah,
so with respect to native species, we also understand that our climate is rapidly changing.
Right.
And so when we're thinking about the future life of these trees that are going to live 40, 50, 60, maybe even 100 years into the future, what is the climate going to look like then? And also thinking about the harsher environments that these trees are getting planted into. So these are not, especially in Philadelphia and on the sidewalks, these are not forested areas. These are under concrete, compacted, are dealing with car doors and dogs and so many other factors coming against the tree. And so we try to plant natives when we can, but we also have to think about survivability. We try out some southern adaptive species. We won't do it in mass, but we'll try some out, see how they fare, which is why we're really dependent and really love our community science program so that we can see how things are doing and then replace it if necessary, or say that did great. Maybe we'll try a few more. And we work really closely with the Street Tree Office in Philadelphia because they have a bigger, broader overview of the trees.
And that's Philly Parks and Rec.
Philly Parks and Rec, exactly.
Yeah.
And in the counties, we offer a number of natives as well. And we try to stay within the species diversity recommendation. And sometimes even being a little bit stricter about it. So outside of the 10, 20, 30, sometimes doing like 5, 15, 20 if we can. And so...
Can you explain that, the number
that's
sequence?
That's a really good percentage thing. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I hope I get this right. But 10 being the family?
The genus.
Is that right?
The genus.
The genus. Thank you. 10 being the genus. 20 being the species and 30 being the family.
Gotcha. Well done.
And so, thank you. And that helps with diversity because you don't want to plant all maples. You want to, if for some reason another disease were to come wipe out a species like we had with ashes, unfortunately, you don't want monoculture for that reason. You want to be able to have a diverse set of trees so that they won't have to deal with the same pests and diseases. And also just for environmental benefit too. It's better to have a diverse...
You know, well, I've been working in that grouping, of people for a very long time. And I remember it was a little controversial that they were planting Taxodium in the city and Metasequoia. And I really wanted Taxodium in our community because we had a problem with flooding. And yeah. I will honestly tell you that those two species were the best thing that could have ever happened to some of the planting areas within the city confines and in the suburbs, because they really lap up a lot of water and they can also take the extreme drought that we've had. Mm-hmm. And I have to hand it to PHS and Philly Tree just to experiment and try different trees that are southern or maybe not native, but have a nice, they play nicely with their neighbors. And I really think that that's a huge value for where the program is now, because you were experimenting way back in the early 90s with this. I remember that so vividly. And a lot of places wouldn't even think of it. And yet PHS and Philly Tree was doing it. And I think that that's really a benefit for organizations like yours.
Yeah, there is an experimental quality, and it does make it fun when something gets planted and you see a success. I want to get back to oaks in a minute and challenge you with a question there in terms of species, but I had the opportunity to plant a hardy rubber tree, Euconia. Yes.
And I guess a popular one right now.
Oh, is it? Okay. And I was going to let you know that the ones that we planted in the neighborhood are doing fine. And as far as I know, they did not take any summer watering. So, whether they also become a seed bank and start filling in the vacant lots, we will find out.
Yeah.
But and then the other one that's raising eyebrows in a good way, I hope, is that Osage Orange White Shield is growing scary fast right now. I think it's added an inch of caliper in 3 years.
Wow.
And shiny leaves and a very interesting branching structure as well. Pretty vigorous, pretty upright, and it does, I'm scratching my head thinking, how do I prune this thing? It's a little muddy.
Yeah, well, I haven't thought about that.
You know, the Euconia almoides we had at Temple for a very long time. It was early on that it was brought there, and it did finally seed in. And it was brought to Morris Arboretum, obviously. Morris Arboretum was one of the very first, and they had to remove all their Euconia almoides. However, in the city where you might have that stress, or if you're just planting all females and not males, you'll be fine. But if you're planting both, you might not be. And again, that comes with the knowledge of, the tree growers and whoever else is involved. And you're right about the Osage Orange. I've had a client who's been begging for me to find her some, and I can't. I said, why don't you try the Midwest? Because they're hard to find. They're hard to find unless you're picking up the seed balls along the road where they used to use them as hedging. There's a couple of places around here that I could pick up the seed balls, but they're hard to find. So if you're using them in the city now, I'll tell you something. They're a tough tree, and they're beautiful, and they're rot resistant. They don't rot.
Yeah.
That's what's so good about them. So there you go. Other trees that you're using. Or I remember there was an argument, we can't use red buds in the city. We can't use red buds in the city because they're an understory tree. But think about, if they're an understory tree, that means you can plant them on shady streets. But, from the concrete, from the housing shading, you can use them on those streets, and they do happily in those spots, But it's just that little bit of tree knowledge makes a huge difference. And boy, oh boy, I think this year was probably the best I ever remember seeing redbuds all over the city, and they were absolutely spectacular. I even came to a screeching halt in the Wissahickon because I saw a group of three Appalachian red on somebody's street, you know, right along the roadway. Gorgeous, gorgeous. And I never remember those as kids seeing those around.
We've had some good discussions about redbud in the past few months, right,
yes.
Eva? Yeah. And I think you always do better with the pronunciation, but some of the cirrhosis that's coming up from the south and the southwest, I think it's going to be fun to see them get planted in dark glossy leaves deep into the throughout the summer
months. The Texensis and the one that they were talking about from California, the Occidentalis, which has that really tough. I was talking to somebody the other day. They were saying, "Can you tell me how many strategies does a red bud have to come out of dormancy?" And I said, two. And I was sharing the story about the gentleman who was talking about having to boil them, put them into boiling water, and then putting them into the refrigerator for 100 days, and then every one of them germinates. But it's the hot water that is the key because there's a waxy coating on the outside of the seed. So those things are priceless as far as information. get excited about those kind of things. But kudos to your group for experimenting and wanting to continue to bring diversity within the community. Our community tree population should be as diverse as the people that are living in the city. That's something that I remember from psychology class. The more diversity in the animal and plant world, the more diversity you have in the human realm. So I think that that's really great that you're doing what you're doing.
So Ashley, what's the thinking these days between Philly Parks and Rec and Tree Tenders in terms of the best urban oak? Do you have one that would be a savior, keep everybody happy? And
I don't have insight into that, to be honest. I'm not sure.
One that I've noticed, and I'm sure Eva sees it as well, and she's going to tell us the botanical, is shingle oak. Seems to be doing just fine.
Yes, Quercus stellata.
Is it what?
Oh, that's the post oak. That's
Imbricaria?
The post oak. No, the shingle oak is Imbricaria. Imbricaria.
Yeah.
But they're in the red oak subspecies, so they do get, because I did this in an experiment when I was teaching at Temple. There was one shingle oak down by Temple University, and it got
bacterial leaf scorch.
So if you shift into, now when I was out in the prairie in August, beginning of August, in these really dry spots, Macrocarpa and the bur oak, even though bur oak is a swamp white oak, it does really good in drought conditions. Those two are really being utilized in the urban settings more than ever before. So I think that they're more adaptable, especially in the prairie, a Macrocarpa. You know, think about, you know, quick moving fire coming through the prairie. Oh, and the tree survives a drought or a long period where you don't have rain and there's moisture in the soil, but there's not a lot of moisture in the air and it starts to get dry. That does really well. Same with the Quercus bicolor, which is the swamp white oak.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I just recently, my position shifted to focus more on Philly groups, but when I was working in the counties, swamp white oak was definitely a popular choice for folks. It does really well in our clay soil.
Yeah, it does. It does.
That holds a lot of moisture. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was in the Haddington Woods. Did we talk about the Haddington Woods project where David Hewitt was doing work down there in Haddington Woods near Cobbs Creek, where they were bringing up southern species for the understory. And that's when they brought up hydrangea cursifolia and some of the shrubby plant material. And majority of it did really well up here, and it was coming from the south. So you look at some of those experiments and you say, wow, that was fortuitous that they did that when they did it, because now we're benefiting from knowing what does survive up here.
Maybe we need to talk a little bit about why Tree Tenders made such good use of bare root trees.
That's a good point.
Yeah, absolutely.
What are the advantages of bare root trees, especially for a volunteer workforce?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if I'm not mistaken, I believe when Tree Tenders started, they were using bald and burlap
trees. That's right. We were.
And That takes a lot of heavy machinery. They are very, very heavy. And also bald and burlap trees just don't have the amount of root stock there. Like they have to cut them off to fit into the burlap at the nursery. And it's also been shown that bald and burlap trees with a thicker caliper, because they're putting so much energy into restoring their roots, the bare root trees with the smaller caliper, maybe an inch less, will actually catch up to the bald and burlap trees. And what's great about using the bare root trees is that they're much lighter weight, maybe up to 25 pounds if they have more root in them. And it's really the hydrogel that is used. We say it's like baby diaper. It keeps the roots hydrated in transportation. That adds a lot of the weight. If it didn't have that on there, that tree would probably be about 10 pounds. And for a volunteer group that's planting, it increases the capacity of what a volunteer group can plant. So you can transport and lift dozens of trees if each one only weighs about 25 pounds. It now expands the type of volunteer that you can bring on. It's a much lower cost. And so we're able to provide it for free to Philadelphia groups and at a subsidied cost to county groups, and do it in a much bigger capacity. I mean, can you imagine planting 1,700 bald and burlap trees in a weekend?
It's like, ouch.
No, never happened.
Yeah. And so the only disadvantage really, and I don't really see it as a disadvantage, we call it out as a disadvantage, that they have a short planting window. And so they have to get in the ground because their roots are all exposed. And that's why we do this big push over one weekend. I don't see that as a disadvantage. I think it's really cool that all these communities are planting at the same time. It's like this big camaraderie of like, oh, we're all doing this and we're all in this together. And we just forested so much in one weekend. It's a really fun time.
Yeah.
It's very gratifying to the people who are doing it too. I was involved in one that they had 150 trees that they planted up in Horsham, Hatboro. And
yes,
I could not believe, everybody was like, they were aghast. Within a couple hours, they were all in the ground. And the holes were pre-dug with a front-end loader, and they were like a perfect rectangle shape for the tree. And the roots just kind of fit in there because they were wide. And I couldn't believe that they got that many in. And it was great to see so many people. And kids could come out. Kids, young children at 5 and 6 years old could come out and help and plant those trees and learn how to do it at an early age, so that when they're teenagers, they're doing a whole group of them, you know, as a group of teens doing it, which I think is fabulous.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially when we're planting in schoolyards too, and we're able to engage the students at the school. Such a beautiful thing that they get so excited, and then they're now the caretakers of those trees too.
Yeah. When my kids were little, I did help out, you know, when they were in kindergarten with tree plantings at the play yard. You know, now you circle back and you see, you know, the sweet gum that I planted 30 years ago is, you know, large and substantial. And I sure hope the kids in the Philly public schools are getting those similar experiences. I want to talk a little bit about, you had mentioned Chester and Norristown, and Chester in particular is, you know, a hard urban living as far as missing canopy. So how does Tree Tenders reach out to a neighboring city that is struggling, such as it is, to build that workforce?
Yeah, it's all about listening, honestly. One of our best practices at PHS is going to the communities and listening first.
Yeah.
We have these resources, but we want to hear from the community. What would they like to see? And then we can best pair them with the resources that we have available.
Right.
The folks in Chester are so incredible. They have a shade tree commission. They have a youth corps that goes out and they do tree planting and tree pruning. They also do gardening as well. And they're just really active. And what we've been able to do in the past is offer free tree tenders classes. We've offer them free trees. So even though they're in a suburban community, covering the complete cost of their tree to remove that cost barrier. And that has empowered them to start the project. So then they feel empowered to look for other grant resources and work with other entities as well in their community. In Norristown, that was a newer partner. We got a grant through Arbor Day Foundation to do that work. And over the course of a year, we did a yard tree giveaway mimicking our partners, Tree Philly. And we also did bare root planting. And we held a one-day tree tenders workshop as well. And it was really exciting. It was in English and in Spanish. And now we're in the process of forming a tree tenders group in that area. And all of this was like depending on listening to what the community wanted and needed. So it's all of them start with, let's have a community meeting. Who are the voices that want to be at the table? And this is really just the time for us to listen to you. And then we'll work together to carry out the ideas that you have in whatever capacity we can. And if we can't do it, then we'll connect you with partners that we worked with in the past.
I love that. Yeah.
Really
yeah.
Critical. Can you shout out again the weekend that you're going to be having the big planting so that anyone who wants to come out and volunteer within Philadelphia and the surrounding area, if they want to go out and check out their community and find out more about the plantings, can you give us those dates and times maybe?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to first shout out that we need some help, PHS, in unloading all of these trees and sorting them on the 14th through the 16th in November. So that is a Tuesday through Thursday. And location is TBD, but the times are 9 a.m. You can do an early a.m. shift, 9 a.m. to about 12 p.m. And then, or an afternoon shift, 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. And we provide refreshments in the morning and a lunch as well. And then for planting, folks can look on our website, phsonline.org, and find a planting near them. And that is the 17th, which is Friday, to the 20th, which is Monday in November.
Friday through Monday. I'm writing this down. In November.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So people have an opportunity to get there. And if you're in a school, if you have volunteer hours for your school that you have to do for high school, get your requirements yes. done in November.
Yeah, there you go. And then it's already done.
It's done. And those yeah. people who work for companies that have to do volunteer hours for companies, get out there and volunteer.
Absolutely. Anyone who's interested in income individuals, and then bring a friend with you. So you don't have to do it by yourself. The more the merrier. Folks who are into other greening solutions in their communities, so community gardening, or maybe they have their own individual garden in their home. This is a great opportunity to learn a new skill and come out and plant with us.
And what about university students? They could come out too.
University students, yep. Absolutely.
You might get bit by the bug, the green bug.
Yeah. It's such like a great, I don't want to say networking because it's not that intense, but it's such a great community building opportunity. There's going to be so many cool people there. You might meet someone that will help you with a goal of yours or just be a fun person to connect with. There's been so many friendships formed at these events and I highly recommend.
You might even meet a chef like yourself.
yeah, exactly. You know there's going to be good food if the chef's involved.
You never know who you're going to meet.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've spent the past hour, obviously, very Philly focused. But what strikes me, you know, our podcast jumps all over North America in terms of the people we interview. But it's distinctly an East Coast thing. You know, I'm thinking of Hartford and Providence and Brooklyn and Philadelphia and Baltimore and right on down the Eastern Seaboard are so many of these cities that are underserved and struggling. And I hope a few, you know, key points have been taken away. If I had to shout one out right now, it is community input, you know, the synergy that comes from planting and seeing something grow in a neighborhood where canopy is lacking is profound, and it's also essential. You know, it's why our podcast exists. Is, you know, we say plant a trillion trees. Well, one thing for sure is every one of those big cities that I just listed could easily use 200,000 trees, 500,000 trees. I don't know what those numbers are, but I do know, I sat in on a seminar a couple of weeks ago. Toronto is meeting its canopy objectives. And I was blown away by that. It can be done, you know, to hear their city foresters saying, yeah, we're getting this done. You know, these North American cities, they need to follow suit. And I also want to make a quick point is we've seen some entrepreneurial spirit come out of this. You know, we've seen nurseries start, and we've seen nurseries like Tree Authority, who's doing innovations in terms of not bare root trees, but soft polymer planting bag. And then we've also seen replicas of tree tenders such as Colonial Canopy, where, you know, they're identifying places in a suburban community, growing their own trees and planting. So for me, it's kind of a shout out too that maybe there's an entrepreneur that is coming up the road that will want to say, hey, let's grow trees on a larger scale in the Delaware Valley or in southeastern Pennsylvania or in South Jersey that can serve Chester and Norristown and Coatesville and Reading and all these towns that used to, you know, have the resources when manufacturing was king. That's not around anymore. But still in all, we should be able to source our trees a little bit closer to home.
I just want to say one thing too. We are a global podcast, and this doesn't mean that people elsewhere in the world can't do what we're doing here. And go to the PHS website and take a look at the resources that they have, no matter where you are in the world. They have models right. That you can follow. And I'm sure that if you were to contact Ashley or anyone in the Tree Tenders organization at PHS, they would be more than happy to help you get your city where it needs to be. And we have to ask you, what's your favorite tree?
This is always a hard question. It changes.
Of course, it's going to change. But hey, today, what is it today?
Today is Turkish filbert, actually.
I love Turkish filbert.
I really love squeezing that bark.
Oh, I love Turkish filbert.
It's such a great sensory filling. It's such a cool tree. And the leaves are so beautiful. When they turn yellow, they're gorgeous.
Was it Corylus? Corylus?
It's the second one that always gets me. Corylus? Corylus?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tongue twister.
That's why I didn't say the Latin. I was like, Corylus.
Always great having you on the podcast. We are so thrilled for you and your new position and everything. So I'm sure we'll see you in the next month or two.
Oh,
yeah,
yes.
I'm coming out to volunteer to lead some tree planting groups as experts.
I hope so.
We will be there.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It definitely is an honor to be here.
Thanks, Ashley. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromeda Recordings in Hollywood, California. Thank you.